This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Yesterday on the show, former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback talked about the various factors that cleared the way for four sports stadium or arena projects to take place in the 12 years he served as that city's chief executive.
Around the time that interview aired, a remarkable offer came to light. Officials trying to gain approval for a casino in Kenosha said they'd kick in $200 million toward a new basketball arena in Milwaukee if Governor Walker would reconsider his previous rejection of the casino.
State leaders quickly dismissed that idea, but the debate over financing for a new Bucks arena continues, with a so-called jock tax still in play in Governor Walker's proposed budget. It's a debate that interests Roger Knoll. Knoll is a professor emeritus of economics at Stanford University, and he's one of the country's leading experts on public financing for sports stadiums and arenas. He joins us to add some perspective to the discussion. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
What are the most vital influences that make new stadiums or arenas succeed or fail?
Politics. a fairly small fraction of the population are actually diehard fans. So it's difficult to get a majority political support to subsidize in a substantial measure any kind of a new sports facility. Consequently, the industry and their supporters try to make the case that facilities add substantially to the economic conditions of the local community, which is not a correct argument, but it's important politically because it's necessary to convince at least some voters to support these things, or else they would never happen.
The idea is to get enough people on board for long enough to get the project through, and then it doesn't really matter what they think.
Right. And then after the fact, when it doesn't pan out, when it turns out to be financially less of a benefit than was initially promised, by then it's too late.
Well, what have you found out in terms of whether an arena can drive development around it or vice versa, the development that exists can contribute positively or negatively towards an arena?
Well, it depends a lot on the whole context. That is to say, an arena that is used a lot, that has many things going on in it other than just the games of a professional sports team, can in fact produce some localized development, restaurants and bars and things like that that are nearby. Whether they do or not, however, depends on the extent to which there's actually a comprehensive plan. Indeed, in some cities, sports facilities have been part of much larger urban redevelopment schemes that maybe last over a decade. And the sports fans then become part of a much larger coalition of people. Like in Cleveland, you have not only the new sports facilities for the teams, but you have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and a new theater district, plus a lot of commercial and real estate intertwined with it for various retail trade. So downtown Cleveland was successfully redeveloped with sports as a component. But if it's not part of a better plan that has a little bit broader and longer term horizon, then there is no economic benefit for having a sports facility or a local team.
So you would say that the key difference here is that cities that look at an arena as a component have some possibility of success, whereas if people expect an arena or a stadium to be a catalyst for everything else to somehow follow, that's where they make the mistake?
That's exactly right. That is that the if you build it, they will come story is not true. It has to be part of something bigger.
So would you say then the economics of building and maintaining a multi-purpose arena, one that would not just host one or two professional sports teams, are different than, say, a baseball-only stadium, which was the last one of these big projects that took place in Milwaukee?
Yes. No, I mean, at the extreme example is a football stadium, which not only is it only used 10 times a year if you don't make the playoffs and 12 times a year if you do, but it's basically useless for almost anything else because we don't have the Beatles anymore, so we can't fill up 75,000-seat stadiums with rock concerts because there's nobody out there who can draw that many people anymore. So when you build a football stadium, from an economic perspective, you're building a black hole, that no one is going to build a new business across the street from a new football stadium for the 12 days a year when people are there. Now, the similar, it's not as bad for basketball as it is for football for two reasons. The first is the arena can be used for other things. It's one thing to try to fill 75,000 seats for a rock concert. It's nothing else to try to fill 20, because there are artists out there who can get 20,000 people. Plus, there are other things you can do in there. You can have it as a major convention site. You can do all kinds of other stuff with it. So if it's managed correctly and designed correctly, then it can be a catalyst for getting someone to build a hotel or a bar or a restaurant across the street. But it does take locating it in a place where all that would be feasible and making certain that the management of it is multi-purpose as opposed to single-purpose. Because even in the case of basketball, that's 41 days a year. And you're not going to go into business if you only have traffic 41 days a year.
The other new model we hear about often is to not just build an arena, but a virtual entertainment center that has, you know, the arena plus attached restaurants and shopping and maybe a hotel as well. Does it matter to the broader economy whether people are eating food inside an arena complex or at bars and restaurants around it?
No, that's an excellent point. What goes on in the local area around an arena is a substitution for things elsewhere. The total amount of money that people in the metropolitan area spend on entertainment and recreation doesn't go up because a basketball team is there or a new facility is there. It's just that it substitutes for other things. So that's why even in the best of cases, the central city might use the construction of an arena and other things, like you were saying, restaurants and hotels, all as part of a bigger development, as a mechanism to refurbish its declining downtown. But that will come at the expense of further development in the suburbs. So it is pretty much a zero-sum game. Unlike when I was a kid, people do not plan their vacations around going to professional sports games anymore because there are so many professional sports teams compared to eight in every league, which is what it was when I was a kid. And that kind of situation where it's not attracting people from outside to any significant degree is the fundamental reason that it's essentially a substitution for people who already live there as opposed to attracting a net increment of new business to the area.
So if you were the manager of a country club, or a golf course or some other sports and entertainment kind of venue elsewhere in the Milwaukee area, would you be kind of rooting against a new arena being built?
Yes. I mean, it seems to me that what effect it's going to have on you is directly related to how far away you are from it. The further away you get from it, the more likely it is that it's going to hurt you.
The case here in Milwaukee is that the new owners of the Bucks and the NBA itself have said that a new or renovated arena is needed or the team is obligated to find a new home. And that is, of course, not all that unusual a threat in this day and age. Is there any way that a new sports facility happens anywhere without this sort of metaphorical gun to the head?
No, it always is a metaphorical gun to the head. It's locally, we just went through the same thing in Sacramento with the Kings, where two or three proposals had to be put before the city and the voters before they finally got one that would take. But it was exactly the same phenomenon. The old owners threatened to move to Las Vegas or somewhere else, and the NBA said the old arena wasn't satisfactory, so Sacramento was going to lose its team. And in the case of Sacramento, it's even a worse threat because it's literally the only major league sport in the city. So, yeah, the city is put into the position of an all-or-nothing decision. They either have to, we call this the Taj Mahal effect in the economics of sports, that you either have to buy us the Taj Mahal or we're moving. And that threat means there's no sort of intermediate happy solution. Like, for example, it would be cheaper just to give the team some extra money every year that would be the profits from the extra seats and concessions in a new arena. So, okay, you know, you're going to make an extra $5 million a year. Here's $5 million. you know, we'll just give it to you. And that would be cheaper than subsidizing a new arena.
Well, give us some history on this issue, if you can. I mean, you reference back in the days when there were eight teams in every professional league. When did taxpayers start being asked to build these new arenas and stadiums? Has this always been part of the equation?
Not always, no. The interesting events took place in the 1950s. When I was 12 years old, my family planned a vacation to Chicago and Milwaukee for the purpose of going to baseball games because we lived in the West and there wasn't a baseball team within 1,000 miles of us. So we actually saw, Milwaukee baseball game as tourists. And that was a common phenomenon because there were so few baseball teams then, and they were all stuck in the northeast quadrant of the United States. That doesn't happen anymore. But County Stadium, you know, was County Stadium. the first major stadium that was built with public subsidies was the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, which was built for the Olympics and then given to an NFL team to play in. And so this is a fairly recent phenomenon. It didn't turn out to be the case that professional sports got their start playing in subsidized facilities. They became subsidized when there was this huge growth in the value of sports that occurred after World War II in the 50s and 60s. And that's when we made the transition from teams being expected to build their own facilities to being helped out by a local government. The movement of the Dodgers and Giants from New York to California was in part done because the cities offered to subsidize their stadiums. In the case of the Dodgers, giving them a lot of valuable land downtown. In the case of Giants, building a park for them. And so it's old in the sense that it's 50 to 60 years ago that this happened, but it's new in the sense it reflected the transformation of professional sports from something fairly minor as just another entertainment to something that was sort of regarded as central to society. And this was, of course, created by television.
Well, and of course, it was the 50s when teams really first started moving and the
yep.
threat that a team could pick up and leave without a new stadium became real.
Yes, exactly right. The threat to move was not an important threat until the 50s and 60s. And indeed, some of the movements were, in fact, generated by television itself because all of a sudden being stuck in a constrained local television market was a serious cost. Whereas, you know, being in Milwaukee when there's no television is not bad because Milwaukee's a reasonably sized city, but it has a constrained broadcast market. It doesn't have a huge regional broadcasting market. And consequently, the relative attraction as Milwaukee as a place to put a team was affected by the rise of television. So teams in Milwaukee would be expected through time to ask for more and more and more subsidy in order to be able to compete with the larger broadcasting markets in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco.
Now, I spoke with the former mayor of Minneapolis yesterday, and he came into office as someone who generally opposed public financing for pro and big-time college sports facilities, but four of them happened in his 12 years in office.
Yes, he changed his mind in order to keep office, right?
Well, and he talks about the key to making them work was to have what he calls a clawback provision, that if these places start making money, the city is assured of getting its fair share. Where do you come down on this idea that the city can actually make back some of what it invests in a public stadium?
Actually, there's an interesting study of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Because of the Twin Cities, there's been competition between the two cities to be the home place of professional sports teams throughout their history. And consequently, they have built more stadiums per capita than any other city in the country. And the notion that these things pay back to the city is facetious because of the competition between the cities, the lifetime of their stadiums is short. Only about every 15 to 20 years, teams get new stadiums or arenas in the Twin Cities. And that's because of this competition. The idea about a clawback because they're going to be profitable is not valid because if it was in fact the case that a stadium in and of itself was a profitable enterprise, then the private sector would be happy to build it. The reason that teams themselves don't want to spend $500 million to $1.5 billion on a sports facility is because it's not a profitable investment. It doesn't generate enough increment to revenue. To go for one of the current sort of Taj Mahal versions of stadiums, which cost so much because they're so elaborately appointed and they're so fancy, that incremental amount of cost is not worth it in terms of an economic return. And that's why they go for the subsidies, because no one would ever do it. Just to give you an illustration, in the Bay Area, both of the major colleges have built new football stadiums in the last few years, Stanford and Cal. And Stanford's cost about $100 million, and Cal's cost about $300 million. The new stadium for the 49ers cost $1.2 billion. And the differences are not great in terms of how many people they actually seat. The difference is in all the other stuff that's in there and how fancy it is, the gold plating. And that would never happen if they had to pay for it themselves like colleges do.
It's interesting stuff. Roger Noel, thank you so much.
Okay.
Roger Noel is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Stanford University and Senior Fellow in the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. One of his key areas of expertise is in public financing for sports arenas. He joined us on the line from California.
Up next, we visit a shop that is among the last of its kind in the state. Stay tuned. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM.